I'm Nikki.
And I'm Kirtana.
And you're listening to The Chat Room.
I remember my school picture day in middle school where I wore the, as we call it, a botu, but a bindi on.
Oh my God, you did?
Yeah.
Is that your most embarrassing picture?
No, I would say probably like my fourth or fifth grade picture where I had to wear like a big bow in my hair. Like, you know, like those old photos back in like elementary school where back when your parents would still like pick out your like picture day outfits.
I would like to relate to that, but my parents picked my outfit and hairstyle until I went to 10th grade.
I thought your response was going to be, yeah, you mean like they did yesterday?
No. Luckily, we have a geographical distance between us, so they can't. They probably would if they could. But my eighth grade one, I realized that I didn't have to tell my parents when picture day was. And
yeah, that's always a choice.
I know, but I just couldn't do it. For eighth grade, I did end up just getting a normal picture taken. But it was like so bad.
You know who probably has looked like as beautiful as she looks now is Richa.
Dude, that's like everyone I've ever is just gorgeous. But I do love it though, because all the women in that show, they look different. Like,
yeah,
they're all just beautiful, but they just look different. And what makes them beautiful is so different for each of them. And you love to see that sort of diversity within our own community.
Yeah, for sure. Anyone who hasn't picked up on it yet, our guest this week is the wonderful Richa Moorjani. You may know Richa from her work as Kamala in Netflix's hit series, Never Have I Ever.
We haven't really had an actor talk very deeply about their actor journey on our podcast yet. And we wanted to be very specific to bring someone on that had a less traditional and like a little more, it's like weird. It's like, her path wasn't traditional, but it's contemporary. Like, this is how people are getting jobs now. So it was just really exciting to have her on, because to get the role on Never Have I Ever, Richa beat out more than 15,000 applicants from a global casting call. And like, I think we all remember the day when Mindy Kaling posted the picture of, hey, anybody can audition for this show. And it was just like crazy. I never would have thought that we would get to meet the person who beat out this many people to be on the show. And now it's been renewed for a third and fourth and final season. So it's crazy. But that's, I'm seeing more and more shows do that, the open casting calls. And so I hope that this is like an episode that encourages people to apply, because you could get it.
Yeah. The other thing that's really cool about Richa, and what I love that we kind of touched on, is like, all of these people on Never Have I Ever, especially like, you know, someone like Richa and Maitri and all these people, like they have very strong like social media presences. And
yeah,
I think what's cool about Richa is that she gets really candid with us about how great that is, sure, but also how tough it can be. You know, it's like when you have that kind of platform, you have to really kind of figure out using your voice and what you're passionate about and what you want to use your platform for. And she's such a strong advocate for animal welfare and environmental justice. I mean, she took part in last year's Hollywood Climate Summit. I mean, those are important issues for her to talk about and to really raise. And I think that like, she just does such an admirable job of that.
And being seen authentic to herself. It's not like performative, like social media from talent is just, people see right through it. And she kind of talks about that too, is being using your power to do what feels authentic to you and advocate for the causes that feel authentic to you.
Mm-hmm. I wish we had asked her what her high school picture day looked like.
Why? Why even ask? She probably looked stunning.
Because I just want to know.
Also, I just remembered what t-shirt I wore for the 1 year that I deviated, because I got there and I was like, oh my God, here's the part I forgot to tell you. I didn't not tell my parents it was picture day. I also forgot
that it was picture day.
It was picture day. So my picture for that year is I'm wearing one of those shirts that says, someone who loves me very much went to Seattle and bought me back this shirt.
But it's a picture, so does it just say someone who loves me very much?
Okay, well, Richa, you brave to pursue the career that I think my mom probably would have been more terrified if I was pursuing acting. But I'm so curious how you were introduced to acting and how you kind of came to realize that one can make a career out of it.
So I have pretty much my entire life, all I ever wanted to do was acting. I started learning Indian classical dance when I was 5, specifically Kathak. Also, my parents are, a little backstory, my parents are also artists. They have a Bollywood music band.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that reaction.
Wait. I want you to continue, but we're going to do a full tangent after this.
Okay. I'll give you like a little backstory and then you can ask whatever you want. But basically, my mom has pretty much grown up here. She moved here when she was 7, and she's a singer. And she's also a therapist, but that's now. And my dad moved to California to get his PhD at UC Berkeley. And so when he was there, he started a band with his friends who he met there, who a few of his Indian buddies, and they were auditioning for a female lead singer. So my mom auditioned for the band and became the lead singer, and then her and my dad fell in love and got married.
This is a 2000s ABC Family movie. Like, totally. This is a movie.
Can we make this, I mean, you got, ask your parents for the rights. Let's do it.
That's like so romantic. Oh my God.
So sweet. How sweet is that? Ugh.
It is. It's very sweet. So I grew up basically at band practices and going to concerts. And then my grandmother I grew up in the Bay Area, by the way. I don't know if I already said that. But my grandmother there also had a performing arts company that she founded that produced Indian classical music concerts. So she was responsible for basically introducing artists like Zakir Hussain to the West.
Wow.
And nice. Yes, I grew up in a very artistic household, and my dad's also an engineer. So education, academics, and arts were kind of equally valued in mm-hmm. my house and in my family. I'm already rambling. I told you I ramble a lot.
No, you're not at all. Not at all. Not even kind of. No.
So when I was 5, my parents put me in Kathak classes, and that's how I got introduced to dance. And through that storytelling, because a large part of Indian classical dance is storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I think you guys already said this, we all grew up watching Bollywood movies. I was obsessed with Bollywood movies, and all I ever wanted to do was dance and be in Bollywood movies. I didn't want to do anything else. So I guess I started doing plays, and I went to college, and I went in as a theater major, but ended up making that my minor and majoring in interpersonal communication instead. And after I graduated from college, I moved to LA. Before I graduated is when I started to think about what I was going to do when I graduated, because my whole life, as I mentioned, I wanted to be in Bollywood. But when I was actually getting to the time of graduating college and thinking about next moves, I realized I don't know a single person in Bombay. I don't know a single person in Bollywood. Yeah. I don't know anyone there at all. I have no connections. And the only reason I never even considered acting here was because this is what we were talking about earlier, is that we grew up watching TV and film here, but it didn't even like occur to me that was like a job that I could have here, because we didn't see anybody who looked like us.
Yeah.
I didn't see anyone who I felt like was somebody that I could follow their path or follow their footsteps. It just felt like a fantasy world. Like, it just didn't even occur to me that was something that I could do if I wanted to become an actor. But around the time that I was graduating college is when we started to see a little bit more representation. People like Mindy Kaling, Hal Penn, and you know, other pioneers. And so that's when I decided, okay, maybe I'll move to LA and give that a chance. So I moved to LA right after graduating college, and now that's been 10 years since then.
Because one of the things that we typically ask people is like, how did you broach the subject of wanting to be in the arts with your parents or with your family? But it feels like it's safe to say with your family it wasn't that traumatic a conversation to have.
I don't even remember having that conversation, because it was just my entire life. all I ever told my parents is, I want to be an actress. I want to be an actress. So it's like they already knew.
Right.
There was never, you know, a time when I was graduating college where I had to like sit down and tell them that's what I was going to do because they already knew.
So basically incept the idea early, folks. Just
as
soon as you have the idea, start as saying the words and just
normalize that conversation as quickly as you can.
Yeah.
But I mean, that being said, you know, yes, I'm very blessed that they were very supportive of my career and very supportive of my dreams and my ambitions. But I mean, they're still my parents at the end of the day, and they're Indian parents. So they still had their, you know, their worries and their doubts, and rightfully so. I think I would also, even though I am an actor, I probably would not be thrilled if my kid told me they wanted to become an actor, because it's a very difficult industry. And the chances of, quote unquote, making it are, I don't want to sound discouraging, but the odds are not great. And especially for us, for people of color, and specifically Asian Americans, I will say. So, you know, they definitely had a lot of conversations with me in the 10 years that I've been here about, or I should say at least before Never Have I Ever, how long do you want to keep trying? And how long do you want to keep doing this? And they never said stop doing this, they never withdrew their support, but it was definitely.
I feel like moving to LA, I get this question a lot from kids, especially that I grew up with back home. Like, do you have to move to LA? Can you start pursuing it out here? Do you feel, as far as it goes with acting, that geographically being in this city puts you at a bigger advantage than if you're submitting self-tapes from the country somewhere and just like not really immersed in the community over here?
Yeah, I definitely think that being here helps. Or I've never lived in New York, but I'm sure even being there would help. And they are different, but that basically LA and New York is where everything happens. New York is a lot more theater based.
Yeah.
And yes, I think that, you know, you can, wherever you live, you can start as soon as you decide that this is what you want to do, or if you're passionate about it. I would say, you know, if moving to LA right now is not an option, then, you know, I'm sure there are theater schools and drama classes, whether it's in high school or after school or whatever it is, just start working on your craft, start training and start collaborating with other people who have the same passion and the same interests as you, because that's how you will start to develop your skills as an actor and start to develop connections and start to learn about how the industry works. So I would say that eventually you will have to move to one of these places, whether it's LA or New York. But in the meantime, there are things you can do to start working towards that, which is what I did.
There are regional theaters that are incredible too.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, there are incredible, incredible theaters that do really, really fantastic work that actually end up being where a lot of shows go for previews to then go to Broadway, you know? So that's a really great place to start. We've said this before, I think, too, like comedy classes, like those exist everywhere. Exactly. Obviously, Chicago is a big one. And then I think there are a couple of other cities that are popping up too. So if you can't afford to go to LA or New York right now, Atlanta is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's still like a wide array of like shows and things like that you could be on. But I think you're probably right in saying that like at a certain point, you may still have to move to one of these bigger cities if your goal is to like, you know, be bigger roles in certain movies, be series regulars on shows and stuff like that. At a certain point, that's probably true. Hopefully that doesn't end up being the case forever, because I feel like it's evolving. But probably you're right for now.
The funny thing too is that most TV productions and even films for that matter don't shoot in LA. You have to be here to get the role, but then once you get it, you'll probably end up moving to like Tennessee or something.
Yeah. I mean, truly, truly. And that's why, like, I mean, look at like Tyler Perry took over how many square blocks of Atlanta, like, and that's like a whole entire world now. And people who live in Atlanta have so many opportunities to work there. That's for sure. And nothing really shoots here anymore. Well, I do have like 1,000 questions about your parents. We'll get to that later. But but I think one of the things you bring up is really important, which is, unless you're incredibly lucky, like in the right place at the right time, because it's not just about talent, right? It's also about luck and kind of like putting in the work and being at the right place at the right time. Yeah. Unless that happens for you right away, it can really, really be a grind. So I'd love for you to speak a little bit more about what that lifestyle is like when you're in the grind and when you're in the hustle. I mean, I think sometimes when you see it on TV shows or movies or whatever, people talk about like, oh, I was a waiter in this, that, and the other. And it, sometimes it can be glorified though. And so I think what's important is to really hear the highs and the lows of it. So can you talk a little bit about what that grind was like for you?
I think this industry and this career, whatever job you have in this industry, is always a grind. I think even after you quote unquote make it, it's still going to be, there's still going to be highs and there's still going to be low periods where you may not have work at all or you're trying to find your next gig. But definitely, you know, before you get, for I'll talk about myself personally, before I got a role like like Never Have I Ever, I, as I mentioned, I had moved here 10 years ago. And well, I guess I booked Never Have I Ever. Now, I guess it's been 3 years, which is crazy.
It's been 3 years
since I booked it. Yes. So I booked it in 2019. I can't do math. Is that 3 years?
Yeah. Right.
I can't do math. 3 years. Yeah. So my career has obviously changed for the better in so many ways since that. But before that, I had been here for I've been here for 8 years. And, you know, I had done a few things in those 8 years, I've done more than a few things in those 8 years, but nothing as big or as widely exposed as Never Have I Ever. And it was difficult. I did not make enough money to survive and to sustain myself as solely being an actor. I had to do all kinds of different jobs and gigs to pay the bills. And there were a lot more low periods than there were high periods, I will say. And if it weren't for my absolute love and passion and dedication to the craft and to storytelling and to my dream of doing this, I'm sure I would have given up. And I know a lot of people who moved here or had already been here when I came here, and they're no longer here because it was too difficult. And I completely respect and understand that because it is very difficult.
Yeah. How did you navigate those lows? Like, did you ever have days where you're like, maybe I should just go back to school and try something different? And if did have those days, what reminded you that, no, this is my calling, this is what I'm meant to do?
I think that a long time ago, I can't even remember who, maybe it was an acting teacher or somebody said that to be an actor, you really cannot have a plan B, because if you have a plan B, then you will give up on your plan A easily and go to your plan B.
Yep.
But if you don't have a plan B, then, and this is all that you have, you will do whatever it takes to get it. So I think that kind of was always my guiding philosophy, was I don't have a plan B. Yes, I went to college, but I moved here to be an actor and that's all I want to do. There's nothing else I want to do. So no matter how long it takes, no matter what it takes, I'm here to do it and I'm going to do it. So I think it was just that dedication. But that being said, of course, there were, you know, days or periods of time where I thought, you know, maybe this won't work and I should go do something else. But they were always kind of brief, I would say, like momentary lapses where I felt that way. And that's kind of the nature of this industry. It's like, you'll be like, okay, I'm going to go home for a month and just like give it a break. And then I'll go home and I get slammed with like 10 auditions. Whereas when I was in LA, I had like no auditions for like 5 months or something. That's kind of how this industry is, to be honest. And that's kind of what's horrible and amazing about it. Because it's like, as soon as you feel like you're about to give up, something will happen that reminds you of why you came here.
Yeah, that's so true. Wow. I literally just went through that. And then somebody a few weeks ago told me the thing about entertainment is it's horrible when it's not wonderful.
Yes.
And there's no in between.
There's no in between.
Those wonderful moments just make those horrible moments go away when you just get that one win. It's not about the 8 passes. It's about the one sale. It's not about the 8 auditions you didn't get called back for. It's about the one you do get called back for.
Exactly. And I think that's what makes it worth it. And I think that's what keeps people going. I mean, like I said, in those 8 years that I was quote unquote struggling, I think struggling is a very subjective term, but you know, in those 8 years, it was hard. But once I booked Never Have I Ever, it's like now when I think about it, everything that I had to go through was worth it. Everything.
And that's the thing that I think sometimes can be really hard to explain to people who are outside of it. Is like, well, why don't you leave? Why don't you just like go do this other thing? You know, you went to college and you majored in whatever. You have to be a little bit crazy.
Yeah, I think we're all a little bit crazy to be doing what we're doing.
I mean, at least a little, right? I mean, there's a gauge on it for sure. But like,
there's a slight element of delusion, that's for sure.
Oh, yes, delusion. It's not crazy, it's delusion. It's
delusion. It's
that, which is its own like breed. Like, I just don't take no for an answer. That's
1,000%. Yeah, and if you just don't have that little like chemical whatever in your head that has those delusions, of course you don't understand. I get not understanding.
Like, yeah, really. I mean, it's illogical to think that you could be that the word no can be said to you 1,000 times and yet you still show up. Like, yeah. you'd have to be crazy, right?
Yeah,
100%. I think that's also like I distinctly remember there was a moment when I was working at the agency and I was in the parking lot and I was crying in the car and I called my dad, who like was so not on board with anything I was doing. And I told him, you know what, you win, I'm going to quit. Like, I can't do this anymore. And he was like, no, you're not. He was like, I don't like what you're doing. I don't like that this is the path in life you've chosen for yourself. But if there is one thing immigrants don't do, it is quit. And you will not quit this thing that you have chosen. And I will.
You just got like chills and emotional hearing that.
I know. I'm like about to cry too. But like, it's that moment. I mean, he was the least supportive of what I was doing. And he is the reason why I stayed, because he told me not to quit. And it's such a real thing. You have to, if you're pursuing these careers, you are taking the biggest gamble on yourself and you have to follow through. You have to commit. The second you stop believing in yourself, it's done. It's over. No one else in this business is going to believe in you if you don't. That's why there's so many idiots that are doing this and so successful at it, because they're like so confident in themselves. Like, you can do that.
But also, like, what a good point from your dad, right? Because like everything you've just said can perfectly be equated to what immigrants have to go through when they come to this country, especially like our parents, that generation of people, the generation before, who had to struggle to just get here. And then when you get here, you're like, I don't know who you are. And a lot of immigrant parents and families, like, they had to come to these small towns and all these random states that maybe have never seen South Asian people before. And you're like, what do I do here? You know what I mean? And exactly, like, everything that, like you just said, Nikki, is exactly equated back to like, you have to claw, you have to like, and you have to like assimilate in ways you don't want to, which is, I think, very similar to things that we have to do. Sometimes we have to do things we don't want to, you know? Yeah. I mean, like, it is literally the perfect, like, it literally balances itself out so exactly. You know what I mean? So yeah.
I'm so glad your dad told you that.
I know, me too. I'm like, oh my God, I would have been the shittiest doctor right now if he had not. Like, Jesus.
You would have been a good doctor. You just would have been a really like bored and annoyed doctor. But you would have
I can't even look at a needle without passing out. How am I supposed to do anything?
I know you say that.
I get a paper cut and I'm calling my mom like crying. Like, I can't look at the blood. But speaking of kind of, you know, the 8 years leading up to you booking Never Have I Ever, what did you work on in between, and what I feel like my perception of acting, which obviously is probably skewed because I don't know anything about it, is like, how do you know you're signing up for a real gig? How do you know what's legit? How do you know what's actually going to propel your career forward? Or maybe you don't know. I'm so curious, kind of, how did you gauge what jobs you were taking? And also, if you have any advice for those people navigating the in-between spaces of what to take versus what not to take in those periods.
You know, when you first start out, there is a whole element of learning about what you should take and what you shouldn't take and what types of people or who you should associate with. You know, everything is brand new. So when I first came here, I didn't know anything, and I would just do anything and everything that I could do just to meet people, go to events and get coffees with people and go to different acting classes and go to shows and sign up for every actor website that exists and submit myself for every single role that I could possibly submit myself for, just to get myself out there. And I think that's kind of what you have to do when you get here, because that's just how you start. And that's how you start meeting people, and that's how you start learning. But yeah, I had to do all kinds of jobs just to support myself financially. I'm very privileged in the sense that my parents did help me financially, at least with, you know, basic things. So I didn't have to do as much as maybe somebody else might have had to do. But that being said, like I was a waiter, I was a cocktail server, I did all kinds of temp jobs and one day receptionist positions at various production companies. I did unpaid and paid internships. I'm a dancer, so I did all kinds of different dance gigs, music video girl. I was an atmospheric Bollywood dancer at a Grammys party one year.
Oh my God. Is it bad that like I just want to do that? Like I want to be a music video girl.
What is the terminology you just used? An atmospheric?
I was an atmospheric Bollywood dancer, which means I was there to be atmosphere as a Bollywood dancer dressed in a Bollywood costume. Even when I say it, it honestly feels weird.
I understand in theory the words in their respective order. Yes. What I don't understand is how Bollywood dance can be considered atmospheric, because I feel like as soon as someone starts dancing like the way all of our kick-ass Bollywood people dance, I'd be like, this is not atmosphere anymore. This is the show.
So when I was when it comes to dance, I did actual performances, which were amazing, and I loved doing them, and I got paid, which was even better. And then there were things like atmospheric Bollywood dancer, which I did not love, and it did not feel great. I was there to basically stand and pose and wear a Bollywood dance costume. Wow. And don't get me wrong, like I probably still had fun doing it, but also did not have fun knowing that I had to do it. You know, when you have to do something, then it doesn't feel good. So I just did, like I said, I did everything I could just to make money and to support myself. And I mean, you know, obviously I didn't do anything that went against my values or anything, but, you know, I just did whatever I could that where I could use my skills. Like I submitted myself for like student films, you know, a lot of student films would be casting on actors' websites like Actors Access or LA Casting. So I would audition for USC student films and all the local film schools. And I did a few of those. None of them were amazing, but it was on camera experience. And I needed that experience to learn and credits. And some of them were paid. Actually, most of them were probably not even paid, to be honest.
Well, and it's hard to get your first couple of gigs just of on camera experience when you're not in the union too.
Exactly. They were all non-union jobs. I didn't join the union actually until probably, I don't know, 6 years after I moved to LA. It took a long time. Wow. But also there's no need to rush into the union, and we can talk about that separately, but there's no need to rush into the union unless you have to. And you'll know when you have to. But one thing I did that was actually kind of funny was I would sit in the audience at the, what's that show called? The Voice.
Yeah. That's the best show.
Yeah, there was a company that I think they still exist and they still do this, that for multiple shows, not just The Voice, where they will cast like a certain group of extras to sit in the audience and like look pretty in the front seats. And you have to sit there for 12 hours. It's not fun. You're basically an extra on set. But at the end of the day, you get $80 in cash in hand, which to me back then was gold.
Dude, my friends and I tried to do that, but like for the Oscars, you can do seat fillers.
Yeah, exactly.
We tried every year to get on that list, and we never did. Apparently, it's a miserable job, as you've just confirmed.
Yeah, it is not fun. You have to sit there for 12 hours and watch the same performances like 5 times, and it's not fun at all.
Oh my God, that does sound awful. I mean, The Voice is one of my favorite shows, but I don't
want to watch it on TV. Is very different.
Yeah.
So what was that audition process like for you for Never Have I Ever?
Well, it was actually very different from any audition I've ever had, in the sense that I'm sure you guys have heard or saw it when it happened, but Mindy posted the global casting call on her Instagram, and it was for the 3 roles of Kamala Devi and Nalini. And everybody I knew, I'm sure you guys knew, everyone you knew too, was auditioning for whatever. Most of the people I knew actually were auditioning for Kamala, because most people I knew were my age or around my age. So I actually, at first, when I saw the post, was not going to, because I just felt like it was overwhelming. And I knew that they were going to get like 15, 20,000 tapes, which is actually how many they got. And I was like, I'm just going to be lost in the mix. What's the point? which is interesting. I honestly don't even know why I didn't think that I should do it. But anyways, after I realized that everyone around me was doing it, I was like, okay, maybe I should too. So I sent in my tape, did not think I was ever going to hear back. But I think it was like a couple weeks later or a month later, I just got a call from my agent and they said that they liked your tape and they want to pin you, which means for people who don't know that you're basically in the mix and you'll be called in for a callback. Or sometimes when they pin you, it just means you that you're basically one of the people that they are thinking of. So I was shocked, and even just to get that call, I could not believe it because I knew that they probably had so many submissions. Yeah. And then very soon after that, they called me in basically for – there was only one final audition after that because sometimes there would be like multiple rounds. But
oh, wow. Yeah, I'm kind of shocked.
It was just basically the last round was in person with Mindy Langfisher, the director, and the casting directors, and it was the test basically. So I went in for that, and it was just me and one other very talented actress who I know in the waiting room, and it was down to us two basically, and it was the most intimidating and scary moment of my life because that was I think that was actually my first test ever too, like the furthest I've ever gotten when it came to a series regular role. So and it was also for a show that I wanted so badly. I wanted this role so badly. So when you want a role, it makes it that much more
terrifying.
Yeah,
because you want it and you care. So I remember right after that, I think it took like 2 days, but those 2 days felt like 2 years. And I was driving and I got the call from my audition from my agent that I booked it. And
That's so cool.
For those who don't know, just as a quick tangent, a test is basically like you do like a studio or a network test. Mm-hmm. Typically what that means is you're doing the same audition pieces or you're doing callback audition scenes for the executives that are greenlighting the show and that are a part of the show to essentially watch and approve you as the choice for that role so that mm-hmm. then you can officially get cast and do your deal, all that good stuff, and be in the show. So that's what a test is.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was just such a tiny room. The room was probably, I don't know, like actually I'm really bad at measurements, but it was probably like 10 feet wide. Is that small?
Oh my God.
It was a really small room. Okay.
It's pretty small.
Yeah.
That's really small.
And Mindy was like literally arms distance away from me, as were everybody else. And I just.
And that's what makes it more terrifying too. I will say that when it comes to the environments of tests, they are changing now.
Yeah.
But traditionally, when you think of what a test looks like a studio or a network test, it's literally like you're coming into a small room, like you just said. There's the video camera, the reader, and the casting director. And then there's just a bunch of seats. And mm-hmm. it's just a bunch of usually white dudes. But again, things are changing, thank God. But typically a bunch of white dudes,
yeah,
like the creators, producers of the show, all just sitting there. You just walk in and you're just like, hello.
So yeah, it literally feels like you're walking into a room naked.
Right.
That's how scary. Right. I am a lot better at auditions now because mostly they're self-tapes and I can take 100 takes before I send one that I am yep. somewhat happy yeah. with. But in person, it's very nerve-wracking, and I'm sure you're a great casting director, but there are a lot of casting directors who are not very friendly, or they will be on their phone texting or eating or just basically not even make eye contact with you. And when that's the first thing that you experience when you're walking into the room, it's very hard not to let that get in your head. So I will say it gets maybe a little easier after you've done a lot of them, but yeah. I still get nervous every single time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really good to know that you still get nervous. I think some people are you just go in and you nail it and that's it, especially when you've already booked a gig. And it's like, no, it's like, I mean, don't like singers say that all the time? And they're always nervous when they get on stage. It just
even on set, I'm literally always nervous.
That's a great segue into, you know, are there certain parts of being an actor, and especially a woman of color, that you wish people maybe talked more about or like knew, or even like debunking a few things that people think might exist, but don't really?
you know, and we've already kind of talked about this, I think people will see the finished product and they see the show or they see the movie or whatever it is, and they don't realize what went behind that.
Yeah.
Or what happened maybe even during the making of it. And behind, there's no such thing as an overnight success or, you know, every single piece of that, what am I trying to say? Basically, there are so many elements that have to come into play and so many people who have to do their jobs well to make that finished product be good. And yeah. Without even one person, and I'm not even just referring to the cast at this point, I'm talking about, you know, the crew. There might be 200 or more people on set, but every single person is important, which is something that I'm so fascinated by when every time I'm on set, just to see how many moving parts there are and how important every single person is. And if even one person didn't do their job well or wasn't there, the whole thing would fall apart.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing just about, I guess, the making of that people don't, who aren't in the industry may not understand. But I guess when you ask like specifically about being a woman of color, I mean, pay disparity is still a very real thing.
Yeah.
I would say, I would argue that Asian Americans are probably the least paid or the lowest paid, especially Asian American women.
Yeah.
It's very sad, but it's still a very real thing. And also I think that I would say not even just actors, but any woman of color in any industry, I think we've been pitted against each other, and we've been made to feel like there is only one seat at the table for us. And so I think it's very easy. It's very sad, but it's very easy, I think, for a lot of women. And I'll speak specifically for South Asians because I've seen it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of performative talk about supporting each other and about lifting each other up and creating a sense of community, because I think a lot of people feel very threatened when they actually see another South Asian person doing something like what they're doing. And it makes me really sad because I really value seeing the people around me, especially my own people, succeeding. And don't get me wrong, like, of course there are times where I do feel jealous. I do feel competitive.
That's human.
But that's human nature. Exactly.
And also, you know, it's the nature of what we do. Like sometimes, to be honest, there really is only one seat at the like physical table for us. And it sucks. But that's why it's our job to create more spaces. And that's why it's our job to take up space and to make sure that we are lifting up our peers and we are celebrating each other's successes. Because if we're not doing that, we can be sure nobody else is doing that.
Yeah, 100%. And I love that even before you said all that, you were like, pay attention to your crew, pay attention to your writers, like pay attention to the people who are not talent, because more of those people mean we have more talent. More writers of color means we have more roles of color to be occupied by people of color. So
yeah, and also just people in the executive positions. It goes. Yeah. I really do think it's a how do you say a top down. Yeah, it really is. You know, if at the end of the day, like we said, everyone in those high up positions are straight white men, there's not going to be that much change, and you're not going to see that reflected. That's what you will see reflected on camera. So it is so important that we advocate for women of color and just, you know, as many diverse people as possible to be in those positions.
Yeah. The thing I always like to say is, because change comes from top down, we have to start promoting people from bottom up. You know what I mean? Like, we have to start spotlighting and growing people bottom up so that change can come from top down.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that makes me so happy also that you work in casting, because I've talked about this before, how representation in casting when it comes to South Asian people, there are so few South Asian casting directors. So I am so happy that you are there, because people in casting have a lot of power when it comes to creating these opportunities for us.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is just really important too, because like, obviously, like, we don't have the final say, obviously, but at the end of the day, we are the people, especially when it comes to like helping with the talent part of things, we are the people who, when we cultivate relationships with producers, executives, directors, writers, we are the people who can say, hey, I see that you wrote this way. Did you ever think about it X, Y, and Z way instead. So I see that you wrote this as a white man or a white woman or whatever it is, right? Did you ever think of it as being someone who's South Asian, as someone who's Black, as someone who's whatever, you know? Anything else, run the gamut. Or the other thing I always like to do is the gender part of it, right? It's like, sure, you wrote something for a man, but why does it have to be a man? Why can't it be non-binary? Why can't it be female? Why can't it, you know what I mean? So that's the place where, even though we don't have the final say, we at least have the power to do something.
And you also have the power to bring in the actors that you want to see for those roles, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Awesome.
Also, like, this is like the whole team. Like, Richa would go up for a part that Kirtana would have her on a list, and then that test would come to me. So it's literally the whole chain of command right here.
And then if Nikki hires me, then I can be the on-set producer too.
Amazing. We're the dream team right here.
We did it right here. It is something that I feel like is ingrained within us. Again, at like from the immigrant person of color background, like we are ingrained, we are taught that, you know, there's this competition, there's one seat at the table, there's this, there's that, there's the other. And I think it's so important for you to hear when people say, sure, that may be the case, there may be one seat, but we need to build a larger table. You know what I mean? We need to do better, we need to do more. And, you know, I think it's extremely important to hear that and to see the action of it from people who are in the public eye, like from people who are on shows and projects that make a difference, that are, you know, popular, that are watched, that are acclaimed, because there is an added platform there. And one of the things that I think is so lovely about you is that you do use your platform for stuff like that. And I think I know one thing that Nikki and I are always really curious about is when people have that kind of platform, how do you navigate being in that public eye, having that platform, and figuring out like how to be, you know, when you have to be sensitive about something, when you decide, no, I'm putting my foot down, I have to be strong about X, Y, and Z. Like, how do you navigate being in the public eye, having that platform, and knowing when or when not to say whatever it is that you want to say or do?
Also, the trolls. How do you combat the haters?
These are a lot of really loaded questions. They're great questions.
Yes, there's a lot of meat inside of each one.
It's a journey. It's a learning process. I have not been in the public eye for very long. It's, you know, I've been on this earth for a very long time, and I've been in this industry for a long time, but I really only got into, if you want to call it the public eye, maybe 2 years ago, whenever have I ever released. And that's when my, at least social media following obviously shot up. And that's when people started to know who I was outside of the smaller groups that knew me before. I would say it's been a journey of learning, but I've had to learn is what you said, is how do you know when to talk about things? How do you know when to be more sensitive about or not talk about things? And I think initially, I felt pressure to talk about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the show came out during the pandemic. And as you guys know, there were a lot of things happening in the world at that time. And I did feel the pressure to talk about every single thing under the sun. And it's not fair that people in the public eye have that pressure, because not only is there pressure to talk about it, but there's pressure to talk about it perfectly and to be absolutely correct and politically correct and grammar correct and just
sure
just in every single way. And it's not possible, and it's not realistic, and it's also not helpful, because we are all different and we should be allowed to, you know, speak truthfully and to make mistakes. I think we're not allowed to make mistakes anymore, which is really a sad thing. We're not allowed to be vulnerable anymore, and that's something that I guess I do try to do, is I try to be vulnerable. I tried to be authentic to being authentic is very important to me, not just on social media, but even in real life. And, you know, in my relationships with people, even if it has nothing to do with work, authenticity is something that is one of my most, I guess, important values. So that's something that I tried to do on social media. And that being said, it's not always easy, but I try. And when it comes to the trolls and the haters, they're always going to be there, and there are definitely times where I would love to respond to a comment, and I have even done it and then had to delete it really quickly.
Yeah.
Never helps. And also, one wonderful thing is that as many trolls are out there, there are also a lot of amazing people out there. And yep. And I've had literally people in my comments defending me to the haters. And I'm like, I'm just going to let them talk for me. I don't have to say anything.
Yeah.
100%. Or I will literally delete Instagram off my phone for like a month or a week or however long I can without having to post something, because I just don't want to deal with it.
The doom, you don't have to deal with the doom scrolling.
Yep. Yeah. I do a lot of social media detoxifying.
Well, speaking of mental health, like we all probably need to do that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. 100%. I think everyone should do it, actually, like maybe every weekend if they can. I try to do it almost every weekend, honestly. You know, even if there are things I should say that, you know, happen in the world or that are relevant that I'm not posting about, it's not because I don't care. It's because I don't feel like I am the right person to talk about it. And why should I take attention away from people who actually know what they're talking about and know a lot more than I do? I don't think that I should be the person to post about things when I myself am not an expert, because people, when you post about anything, they expect you to be an expert. So if you're not an expert, you can still post if you want to, but if you don't want to, don't do it. And that's what I've learned.
And I'm sure there's also pressure sometimes with not posting, right? Like it's like, oh, well, this thing happened. Why didn't Richa post about it?
That happens all the time. Yeah. And I've just learned you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, because if I do, and even if I care, but if I just don't know about it well enough and I post something, I will get attacked for it. And then I feel like shit and it affects my mental health because I'm like, well, maybe I shouldn't have posted that. So I've just learned that now I only post things when I feel very passionate and I really feel moved to say something. I don't post anymore unless I feel moved to say something.
Oh, I love that. Honestly, famous or not, you should be doing that.
I think that is like regardless of whether or not you have a platform. I just think that even people who don't have a platformer or whatever you want to call people, I think everywhere feel the pressure to talk about everything these days. And it's distracting. Like I said, it's distracting from the people who really know what they're talking about.
I agree.
Well, totally also agree. Like you can be moved by something and not want to post about it.
Exactly. You don't have to post about it. Yep. I think that's something that is so important to me is self-care, because we live in a world where there is everything out there to screw up our mental health. So I think self-care is so important. And especially when you are somebody who talks about things that could be not controversial, but I guess when you feel like there's a lot of pressure on you, or you feel like you're putting things out there that are making you feel vulnerable and people are responding to that in different ways, it is so important to take care of your mental health and to just feel grounded and to realize there is a whole world outside of social media and there are other important things in life outside of what people see of you on Instagram.
Yeah, absolutely.
1,000%. Detox, everybody. Let's all detox. Let's all follow Rich's move to detox.
Just get off Instagram and pet your dog. That's what I do.
There it is. Or go get tacos, which is what I'm about to go do.
They're bringing, speaking of tacos, they are bringing the Mexican pizza back to Taco Bell. And
oh my God.
There is a God. The Mexican pizza is coming back.
I think the Mexican pizza is just okay.
Okay, well, this is a polarizing conversation.
Yes.
Rich is like, you guys see the hours up? I gotta go. So
sorry, I don't get it. I just don't get it. I'm like, do I need to do 23andMe and figure out if I'm actually Indian? Because maybe. I don't understand the Mexican pizza.
It's so funny to me that every piece of news that came out about the Mexican pizza coming back literally referred to the South Asians, like popular. I'm like,
I seriously didn't even know. I thought I was like the only person that ate Mexican pizzas until they got rid of it and there was like an global outcry.
The moment I heard an NPR podcast about it when it went away, that's when I realized as well. I was like, there is an NPR podcast about the influence of the Mexican pizza, like the Mexican pizza's popularity with South Asians.
I felt so validated and seen when I realized I wasn't the only person that was so hurt about it.
Exactly.
I was hurt by potatoes. They took away my potatoes and I was hurt about that, but then they brought them back. So
did they bring them back?
yeah, we got the cheesy fiesta potatoes back, y'all. It's back in full form.
There it is. And all thanks to like random celebrities that like say things. I remember like when Chance the Rapper was mad that Wendy's did away with the spicy chicken nuggets or something. And he tweeted about it and they were like, it's coming back, y'all. Like a month later, I was like, this is it. See, everybody just needed to say, bring back the Mexican pizza.
I remember I was at a wedding. And I met, actually her name was Richa. I met a girl named Richa. Who is Indian and works at Taco Bell corporate, and I literally yelled at her about the next.
What? Well, and because their reasoning was so stupid, they were like, "the box is not environmentally friendly." I'm like, because you can't make an environmentally friendly version of the box you serve the Mexican pizza in.
I think that was a bogus excuse.
Exactly. I'm also like, I agree.
Is the food environmentally friendly? What's going in the Taco Bell? Like, what am I even eating?
Since when was Taco Bell a green company? I was not aware.
When did this change happen that I did not realize?
Any sense
like happening? On that note, thank you so much for chatting with us today. I had to do it. I had to do it. I had to. We really appreciate you coming on and talking with us today. We just love you. We just think you're so great, and you do have just a wonderful reputation about you, like. Everyone that we know in the industry, like in our South Asian film and TV family, like they just have the nicest things to say about you. And clearly that was accurate.
Being nice works, guys. We can be nice and successful.
Exactly. Well, it's a lot harder for a lot of people than it should be. But yeah. I 100% agree. Like the most simple advice I can give anybody is be kind and work hard. That's it. Just, you don't have to do anything else. Just do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1000%.
The Chat Room is hosted by me, Nikki Menon,
and me, Kirtana Sastry,
in partnership with Brown Girl Magazine.
Pallavi Sastry is our consulting producer.
All podcast artwork is created by Ashwarya Sukesh, and opening music is by Shridath Bambipati.
Special thanks to Thrisha Sukujawalia. Please subscribe to The Chat Room on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening right now.
Thanks for tuning in.